Well, hello, I'm All Over the Place podcast listeners. This is Dara Starr Tucker, and we have a little bit of a different episode for you today. I was recently a guest on a German podcast called Nachsitzen, and the English translation of that would be detention. It was not in German. We did the interview in English. Now, the hosts of this podcast are super bright. A couple of them are social behaviorists. They're very curious people. And the idea is that they are sitting in detention, even though they are experts in their field, but they are pulling in people that they consider to be knowledgeable in other areas, and they want to hear from them and learn from them. So that's what you're going to hear today. We talked about the subject of cultural appropriation, and it was just a good, meaty, hearty conversation that I feel you guys would benefit from. So we decided to do a bit of a cooperative concept for this podcast. It will be aired on their podcast, and it was live streamed there in Germany. And then I'm also going to share it with you. So I hope you enjoy our talk. We will be back again with another traditional episode very soon, but I hope you all enjoy this talk on cultural appropriation. Thank you all so much for listening.
And we are live. Hello, Dara.
Hello.
Today, we are going to talk about, and I kind of fooled the people into thinking that this is going to be a very positive thing, because I titled cultural
appreciation.
admiration. It gets confused in my head right now, and I thought that, well, maybe people think, oh, it's not appropriation, so it's not going to be that bad after all. Well, but lo and behold. You may have guessed it. We are actually going to talk about cultural appropriation and admiration. No, what's the other thing?
Appreciation.
I knew that. The appreciation as at least some way to handle it. Well, we'll see if it's possible. And as many of you may have guessed outside, out there on your little TV and computer and iPhone and mobile screens, we are talking English today.
We try to.
Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's see how it goes.
Let's see how it goes. So, but first, let's introduce our guest properly. Dara Starr Tucker, it's absolutely fabulous to have you here. You're a jazz singer and are very good at that. Marvelous. And you are a, can I say that, a podcaster?
I do have a podcast, but I am a kind of, I call myself a social commentator.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of activism involved?
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, like they're kind of video essays or, you know, social commentary. Yeah, I definitely like to comment on things. And so, yeah, my videos they run the gamut, though. I do not only do activism, I do a lot of education and information and, you know, celebration, all kinds of things. So, yeah, video commentator, video essayist.
Yeah. And that was actually how I stumbled upon you. Would you say stumble upon you? That sounds wrong somehow. That sounds like we're lying in a huddle somewhere.
Came across.
Came across, yeah, right. This is going to happen a lot of times. Okay, so I came across your clips because I was watching another video by a guy who calls his channel Polyphonic, and he was talking about cultural appropriation by the band Led Zeppelin, and frankly, I didn't know too much about that, and I was shocked by what I heard, and then I had to kind of verify that because that's what you do today. First, when you hear something, you verify it. And boy, was I verified. Because, and that that was how I came across your clips. Actually, you were talking, the first clip that I saw that you made was about Elvis Presley. And the name of your clip was Elvis Presley a racist? Mm. And this would actually be my first question. Because the people who watch us now might not have seen your video. So I'm asking the question again. Was Elvis Presley a racist, Dara?
From everything that we know about Elvis, I don't think that he was. No, I don't think Elvis Presley was racist. Elvis Presley, a lot of people don't know is that he didn't actually talk to the press a lot. After about 1957,
because he encountered so much resistance to what he was doing, both by black people and white people.
Okay.
A lot of folks didn't like what Elvis was doing. They didn't like the, you know, the encouragement of miscegenation or the mixing of the races. They didn't like what he represented. And so, you know, in the South, white people would burn his records, and he got a lot of flack from his own folks. And I think in 2023, it's very difficult to kind of plug into that mindset. It's difficult to think about what the climate would have been in 1956 or 57 mm-hmm. when he came along. Nowadays, he gets a lot of flack from the black community, and understandably so. It's a lot of flack from black folks for being known basically as the king of cultural appropriation. That's how he's regarded by a large swath of the black community. And it's funny because I've done several videos on Elvis, and I with the one that has gone really far on YouTube, the one that's done, you know, better than many is when I asked the question, why do black people dislike Elvis?
Yeah, I saw that video.
And yes. a lot of white folks did not have any concept that Elvis was as derided or as disliked as he was in the black community. And so, yeah, I think by, you know, to look back on what he did, he's honestly one of the most misunderstood people out there, just because he shut down after about 1957, because you had so many crazy accusations being made against him. He really stopped talking to the press. He stopped doing interviews. And so there's a lot that we don't know mm-hmm. about him. A lot of what we know is conjecture. It is speculation, what people think about him based upon what he did or what's been said about him. But no, I don't happen to think that Elvis Presley was a racist. I think he was someone that grew up around a lot of black folks, and he was inspired by what he saw. But I will say preemptively, growing up around black people or growing up around any culture in particular does not necessarily give a person license to then take elements of that culture without any concern for potential exploitation. Because regardless of how many people, black people, Elvis grew up around, Elvis was still a white guy. Regardless of anyone's speculation about him being Melungian or possibly mixed with this and that, his experience of the world was as a white man. And so the impact for black Americans was that they felt that a part of their culture had been taken from them and co-opted. And so, yeah, there is this very complicated relationship that black America has with Elvis Presley.
But there is one thing that you said that I think, to me at least, was some kind of a key to the whole thing. Because first I thought, well, what's that about? Like, you know, with cultural appropriation, isn't it a good thing that cultures... And I'm saying this naively as I was, isn't it a good thing that culture in general mixes with other cultures, which actually you as a cultural scientist should approve of, because we need to learn from each other and grow up together. And if culture A does something that kind of propels us forward, it would be a great thing if culture B and C and D also kind of get in the game and we grow together as humankind to make stuff better. But the thing that kind of was the key for me is the exploitation of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not so much as like the influence or, you know.
I think the problem is when two groups come together, and there is obviously cultural exchange. You can do nothing about it. It just right. happens, but it has to happen on equal footing, mm-hmm. on equal right. terms, and there has to be respect for one another, and there has to mm-hmm. be an awareness in the dominant group if there are problems that the minority might have, and you have to be really aware of the problems, and so. Mm-hmm. It isn't sometimes even about respect only, but you have to be aware of the problems. As you say, he went through life as a white guy, Elvis Presley, and he didn't encounter those problems, really.
And what I also watched those videos, and what took me really aback was that the music, not all of us, but a lot of his songs were also performed, sung, or written even by black people. And it was considered at the time
as an Elvis song.
It was considered, this is race music. You called it race music in your your show. So the American people at the time, the white American people, said this is race music, and it was not played in the radio stations, and it couldn't get famous or popular or something. And then they were looking, I think the guy that recorded the first song with
Sam
Elvis,
Phillips,
he said, if you bring me a white guy who sings like a black person, I will earn $1 million. And that's the exploitation part of it. Because all those black artists were totally capable of interpreting and performing the song and their beautiful versions of the songs. But they didn't get the success for their work. So here comes the white guy, Elvis Presley. He does it, and he's socially acceptable in America at the time from the white majority of people there, and that's really a problem. And in your video as well, just to put the record straight, you said Elvis Presley, as far as we know, was always aware of this. He always said, "I'm just able to do what I'm doing because black people have written those songs, have performed, I got inspired by them." So he seemed to be somewhat knowledgeable about the fact that he's only successful because of it. Yeah, he's privileged, and he's standing on the shoulders of all
giants.
Those, of other giants, yes. Yeah. And he has the chance, and they don't have the chance. And this is the part that
Yeah, but he never really, at least to my knowledge, or that I couldn't find, really, really, really stood somewhere publicly saying it.
Right.
Never.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, which is the issue that a lot of black folks have with Elvis. But as I said, after about 1957, when he was getting flack from all sides, he was getting flack from his own people and being called every name under the sun because of encouraging this sort of mixing of the purity of whiteness with this very, you know, down and dirty element of black music. He was getting so much flack from his own folks, quote unquote. And then he was getting flack from the black community for, hey, man, you just came in, you came and swooped in and did this music that we've all been doing for years. And now suddenly you're rich and famous off of it. And people are calling you the king. What is this? And so because he was then a quote ended up circulating, which was a false quote that said that Elvis had said, the only thing black people can do for me is shine my shoes and buy my music. And this is a very, very famous quote that was put in a black publication that was later refuted by a very significant black publication called Jet Magazine. And they addressed this quote in 1957, and they asked Elvis, you know, did you say this? He says, well, you know, I love black people, and anyone who knows me knows I would never have said something like that. That's not something I would ever say. I think, you know, the testament of the black people, so many black musicians of his time really did. They liked him a lot, you know, thought he was a good kid, thought he was talented, and, you know, certainly probably didn't agree with the assignation of him being the king of anything, but they appreciated his talent. And they always said he was respectful and, you know, in behind the scenes, he had, from what we know, very good relationships with a lot of black musicians. But that quote being thrown out into the public sphere, there are still so many black people today in the United States who believe he said that. Most black folks believe he said that. And there was a song by a group called Public Enemy in the late 80s that referenced Elvis. They said something about, you know, the only thing Elvis is the king of, I don't remember what the line was, but a lot of people my age who grew up on hip hop grew up with that Chuck D quote that maligns Elvis and John Wayne. I mean, John Wayne's another story. But that is a lot of our impression of Elvis Presley. A lot of folks I know and grew up with have no love for him whatsoever, partly because of that quote. And then just the general perception that he took a lot of shine away from the black community. So there's a lot of disdain for him. Understandably, he's become representative of something, I think, just because he was the biggest. He was just such a huge artist. He became representative of something that was, it was a much larger problem than just him.
Absolutely.
And his manager didn't help. by exploiting financially him as well as the other artists that usually wrote the song. So there's another problem on top of that because his manager really exploited the people.
So since we're here to learn a lot, and my God, my head's already exploding, one very basic question. What would you think, Dara, who would you think is actually the king, or who are the kings and queens of rock and roll?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Joseph M. Wanted with the Christitutionalist Politics. Tune in for the upcoming episode for May 4. Issue, Never the Issue, as well as guests Peter Serafin, Rosemary Downer, Don Gallade, Gista the Rapper, Cy Young, Jason Perry, and upcoming Jack Hagar, Andrew Thorpe King, Trent Rock, Ed Temple, Chris Morehouse, and more. Please tune in to Christitutionalist Politics. God bless.
There are a lot.
Maybe it's a personal question. So you can pick a personal answer. You don't have to be scientific about it. What would you think the king and queen of rock and roll? Early rock and roll, of course, that is.
Early rock and roll. The person that I pinpointed, I did an entire video, and I don't know if you all referenced it, that you've seen it. It was called Who Invented Rock and Roll? Yeah,
that's why I asked, frankly.
It's kind of it's a bigger question than anyone can really answer, because it's like asking when the night becomes the day. It's very difficult to pinpoint exactly when rock began, but I would trace the true DNA of rock and roll back to a man named Louis Jordan, who was really the architect of the jump blues sound, which is essentially what rock and roll was built on. Jump blues. So it's the thing that really combined kind of the blue notes and the chord structure of just the blues with that sort of rhythmic driving element that became rock and roll. Now, rock and roll expounded on that. It basically sped that up and added wailing guitars, which, as I said in that video, a black man named Elmore James was already doing. We already had those grungy guitars, but it just kind of combined some elements and basically put a bunch of white kids at the forefront and made it young. You know, it made it feel like a very young, current, modern thing that could, that could be stamped with a name, with an identity. But I think Louis Jordan is the father of jump blues, and I think in my estimation, he's the father of rock and roll.
I came across the song "Shake, Rattle, and Roll" it sounded like the proto rock and roll song by the name escapes me, by that big guy,
Bill Haley and the Comets.
No, earlier, the original, the big black guy who had a voice like you would think that he never used a microphone. What's his name? Big Joe Turner.
Oh, okay.
Big Joe Turner. That was something I came across quite a couple of years back, and I thought, because I only kind of knew the white versions, Elvis's version, which I still think is quite quite enjoyable, actually. But then I came across this this other version, the earlier version, and everything is already there.
It is there. It is there.
Everything. Everything is there.
You know? The DNA is really intact.
It's more than DNA, actually, frankly, because it's just, Elvis added not so much to it.
Whiteness. He put some whiteness on the top of his name, probably.
And there's just a pinch of whiteness. Yeah. He added whiteness, and frankly, he had a very unique way of using syllables and kind of bending them. You know, like Jerry Lee Lewis, who I think is an interesting stylist, and I was really a big fan of his till I found out what a he is, and I thought that he had an interesting way of just using speech and breaking it just to his will. He bent the speech, the way of speaking, the, everything to his will, and just added syllables if he wanted to. You know, there is some extent of creativity involved, but if you compare it to a Chuck Berry song or to a song of a Big Joe Turner, it's not that much that they added, actually. It's not that much.
Just to add some, because someone, which name I can't pronounce in the chat, Gwyn, I don't know.
Gwynifer?
No. This one would be able to do. Wrote, Elvis danced and people freaked out. And even the dancing and the performance was ripped off.
Was ripped off.
Yes.
And you can watch it in Dara's video. You put those montages
side
together.
Side
by side. And you really see he was not that innovative. He looked what other people are doing. Yeah.
If you have heard a singer, if you have not heard a singer named Roy Hamilton, go look him up when this podcast is over, and it will further break your heart in terms of the
Oh, great. Yeah, let's do that.
That Elvis Presley was an original. I just had someone, and I have pushback constantly in my comments section. Well, Elvis did this, and he was that. And it's like, it's hard for me as a fan. I am a fan of Elvis to come back at these people, but they're so adamant that he started this and he began this and he was an original. It's like, have you heard Roy Hamilton? Elvis Presley acknowledged that that's where he got his sound. And it is a complete, sorry to say, it's a complete ripoff of Roy Hamilton. That that thing, that's Roy Hamilton. And he was an amalgam of so many people. So it was not, he didn't only rip off Roy Hamilton. I mean, he loved Dean Martin and many other singers. But, you know, even the signature Elvis swagger thing in his voice that we identify with him, it's not just him. And Otis Blackwell, who wrote several of his songs, if you watch a performance of Otis Blackwell's on the David Letterman show, which is on YouTube, you're going to hear Elvis, because Elvis imitated the demo that Otis Blackwell made for him. Hmm. So even his, you know, even his singing style, it's sad to say, but he really wasn't all that original.
Can we kind of, how can I say that? Can we kind of somehow get to the fact that to a certain extent, or maybe a big extent, it's okay that musicians learn from other musicians, because I can almost hear the choir going, but that's how it is. And we need to acknowledge that, because yes, it is.
My question would have been, where would you draw the line between an honest mistake or cultural appreciation or cultural exchange and cultural appropriation?
Or even learning.
Yeah.
You know, because I have to, if I want to get better at guitar, what I do is I watch other guitarists and try to emulate
and try to get better.
Yeah, or inspiration. Where is the line between inspiration and appropriation and downright stealing? Or is there no line?
Well, you are correct in that. I mean, as you said in your opening, I am a musician. I am a singer. And I am the product of all of my influences. If you heard my mother sing, you would know part of why I sound the way that I sound, you know, and other people that I'm heavily influenced by. So, of course, we all have our influences. But I think when that element of culture and race then comes into the equation, that's when it becomes a much more complicated and nuanced conversation. And so, again, there are very few hard and fast dividing lines that say, this is when it is this, and this is when it is that. And it really is a case-by-case thing where we have to just evaluate the totality of where that person comes from and exactly how they came into the influences that they did, and exactly how they have they handled it responsibly. Then sometimes I think, you know, simply stepping back and saying, well, you know, I grew up around Black people, and I just, you know, I was around a lot of Asians, and I just loved I loved their culture. I think sometimes that can be a very false defense. It can be a defense for ignorance. And that is sometimes ignorance that leads to cultural harm. So I think just that innocent defense of, well, this was just the type of music that I loved, doesn't necessarily preclude someone from causing the type of harm that can be caused through cultural appropriation. So I think it's fine to be influenced by the things that you're influenced by. But I think when you are a member of a dominant culture, you have a certain responsibility to educate yourself and to be informed and to be careful that you are not causing harm. I think it's just an awareness that you have to have.
Sort of moral compass, maybe?
Yes, absolutely. Because there is no litmus test. There is no way to just say, this is appropriation, this is appreciation.
Well, that's what we Germans want. You know, clarity.
You mean we
rules?
Yeah, we have to reduce the complexity. Yeah.
Complexity reduction. Alexander, you wanted to say something for about half an hour, I guess.
Thank you.
No problem.
I forgot my question. No, furthering this topic, I was really again shocked by listening to you how the music in the USFA developed. Because the white people, they had classical music at one point, and they had some sort of folk music, which they imported to the US somehow. And then the jazz was, and you did a whole video on it, and I can't recite it. It's very clear that the influence of the Black Americans did a number on the music, and it changed. And then there was it finalized in rock and roll. So now the white people appropriated rock and roll and made it their own, and suddenly it's a white thing. And then the black community, if I understood your video right, then changed and went into another direction. So there was hip hop, for example. Or another way to express yourself, to differentiate yourself, to have some sort of your own cultural way of delivering.
Yeah, or even earlier. I mean, I guess that you could say the same about the James Brown way of funk.
Yeah,
you know,
Motown and
we're at Motown, right? Where people try to have their own thing again,
right.
And then the white
guy rides in.
Yeah, that was a shocking thing. And then again, the white people just took it for them. And again, there's white hip hop. And then we do have the things like, I listened to Rage Against the Machine when I was younger, and I thought it was really. It made a thing on me because they were angry when I was young. They really had political topics, and now years later I realized hip hop was stolen, rock music was stolen. So they had their angry attitude maybe that they brought on the platter, but all the rest was really not their own. And I'm so shocked about that. It's really I went through my CD collection. I think, well,
where is the original?
what can I listen to?
Well, you can. I guess, Dara, you really need to release us here.
If you can.
Are we allowed to listen to the stuff? Please. And please, no.
I have to burn my CD collection.
No.
Right after the show.
You need a lot of fire to burn CDs. But yeah. So please, could you, is there some way to redeem us?
To redeem you?
You're laughing. That's not a good sign.
She can't do it.
There is a point, I think, when you, and it's just interesting because for me as a Black person, I grew up around a lot of white folks now. I grew up in an environment that was heavily influenced by music that did not come from my culture. So I have gone through my own journey in understanding, like, hey, a lot of the music I grew up appreciating came from Black folks that I didn't even know. I had to go through the same process that you all are going through, even though I grew up, you know, very deeply steeped in the church, which is where a lot of our folk music traditions originate. So I knew, but I didn't know, you know, I didn't really deeply understand. And so I'm going through my own journey of just like looking through my own collection of music. Like, wow,
this is crazy.
This is Yeah, it's tainted a little bit. It's like, can I really sit back and appreciate someone like Elvis like I used to? And the answer is, I can't. I appreciate what he was and what he did and the talent that he had, and I acknowledge all of that. But it feels different now when you step back and realize what the true story is behind a lot of this. Even when I watch old movies and I watch people like Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire and people who put a lot of syncopation into their music, which is really what was happening in the swing and big band and jump era from the 30s and 40s. A lot of that was derived, all of that was derived from Black culture at the time. If you look at what they were imitating and what they were pulling from, then it's just mind blowing. It's like, oh, this is what they were doing. This is where this came from. White people did not get up one day and suddenly decide to start snapping on 2 and 4 and treating each other like hepcats, you know, and using a lot of jive and syncopation in their music. They didn't have this before. And then, you know, the other element that really, you know, you have to think about is that when this type of thing was introduced, or when it really only existed in the Black community, it was vilified. It was talked about. I mean, you listen to the way Henry Ford, I don't know if you all have watched the video I did on Henry Ford, and you may know a lot about him just because Hitler was such a huge fan of his and had his picture up on his wall. And he was such a raging anti-Semite, and he was so horribly racist that he thought Black music, and it wasn't just him, but he thought Black music was the scourge of the earth. He thought it was just the thing that was tearing down the moral fiber of the nation. This is Henry Ford. And so he initiated a program where he put square dancing into all of the schools. He encouraged all of the schools to initiate square dancing programs because he wanted basically to whiten up America's music through their educational system. So the way that Black music was regarded, this is why the level of hurt, this is why there is such a level of hurt that exists. And this is why these conversations need to happen, because it wasn't as though, oh, there's just Black music over here and there's the white folks over here, and we're sort of politely mingling and borrowing with each other. It's like, no, Black music was treated like the devil's music. If they heard blue notes and things that, you know, if you know about piano playing, you know that the black notes are the sharps and the flats. And if that kind of thing was incorporated in the way Black people express themselves, it was seen as devil's, you know, music. An evil force. Yeah, it was from the devil. And so for that thing, you know, Black people to be derided for that, and then suddenly, oh, now it's okay. It's good, because now, you know, it's
because the skin color changed. Suddenly, the exact same stuff, the exact same notes are not of the devil.
Right. Well, suddenly, this is all it just has a different face.
With Elvis in the beginning, there was some backlash in Europe against Elvis, because he brought the somewhat Black music, or the music that went against the social order in Europe, to Europe. So even though he was a white guy, which made him more acceptable in the United States, there was a big backlash.
My father told me about that. He said he was 6 years old, I guess, when the war was over. So he kind of grew up on, how can I say this? He wanted to listen to rock and roll, but it was not easy in those times, in Bavaria at least. And so what they had to do to listen to those records was they had to go to a fair, you know, to some kind of event. And there was a... I don't know, what's the American word for autoscooter? Cars who bump into each other?
Bumper cars.
They had to go to those bumper cars thingies, because their DJs were kind of allowed, why ever, to play the newest records. And so they huddled over there. Wow. They didn't have the money to actually drive a bumper car, but they just huddled there pretending to buy a ticket very soon, maybe.
Just to listen to the music.
Just to listen to the music. And
wow.
This was when he said he heard, what was it? I think he said Heartbreak Hotel. And they didn't understand the word English, actually. But he said, and my father was not very into music, actually, but he said it struck something in him, not a chord, I guess, because
he didn't know what a chord is.
But he said something electrified them all when they heard that, and they just heard it. And Heartbreak Hotel is not a typical rock and roll song in any way. It's more blues than it is rock and roll, I guess. But he said it struck something in him, and then they, of course, had the Bill Haley and every other stuff. And he said it was interesting that they all suddenly felt some kind of what's the word? It's not aggression, but some kind of explosion happening in your brain that you can free yourself of something by getting loud. And it was really, really interesting talking to me about the stuff, because normally he wouldn't talk about that too much. And the same thing happened with him and his friends with James Brown a couple of years later, where they felt this strange outburst of energy that he says changed him as a person, which is interesting, because normally I think my father stayed practically the same from when he was 8 years old to when he when he died. He was the same. So that music somehow changed him, or actually touched him in a way, and it was rock and roll music. Is really very deeply emotional for me.
Wow.
Yeah. But it was black music, essentially. Yeah. My father got changed by black music.
Yeah.
Man, or at least touched by it.
Yeah.
I don't think it changed him, actually, now that I think about it. He just stayed the same.
Just
but
he was touched. In that moment.
In that very moment when you told me that story, yeah.
Just to interject a comment from Darren Morin, he says, thanks a lot to Dara. Now I begin to understand. So,
wow.
Detention
Wonderful.
Is working.
Yeah. That's one. Okay. Let me just cross.
Nearly, what do we have? Nearly 4,000 at the moment. So
4,000 people.
Wow.
Great.
Wow.
Anybody complaining so far?
There always are.
Where they're well behaved, there are some people saying why it's bad with Rage Against the Machine. They're just mixing stuff. Why is that bad? And I think if you have listened to the first half hour of our show, you will understand why you should feel a little bit.
Let's dive a little more into the thing that Alexa said about this, the different levels of domination, about the domination, because we didn't talk too much about that. There is you might say there is a dominant culture, a dominant group of people, white people in that case, and the,
usually
and the oppressed group. And if these two are not level with each other, there is going to be some kind of exploitation. That's how I understood it. And this exploitation very much has to do with recognition, if I understand you correctly, and with just bare-bone money. I mean, people don't get paid for stuff they invented.
Right.
And they don't get the acknowledgement.
Yeah, the acknowledgement, credit, right.
Yes.
Because as I understood it, it's a little complicated in my head, because the blues musicians themselves tended to, well, not steal, but kind of take the riff of Dust My Broom, wiggly, 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 wow, and put some other lyrics on it. And it was not considered stealing, was it?
Mm-hmm. No, between black blues musicians is what you're saying?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was a genre of music. So they all were sort of, you know, sharing and exchanging, and it was just seen as a communal thing. It was folk music, which that's the nature of folk music, is that it's freely exchanged and freely given, and no one owns it. No one owns anything. So yes, of course, they were all heavily influenced by each other. It's the same chord structure or chord progression.
You know,
from one blues song to another, a lot of them didn't sound that much different from each other. They would just make little tweaks here and there. And it's like, okay, this is, you know, this person's style versus that person's style, Robert Johnson versus, you know, another blues musician style. But they were all, you know, they all existed together. And that was, it was communal music. But once you take it out of that folk setting, then it becomes something very different.
Well, I think, or maybe you, you really want to correct me heavily on that, but once somebody else takes it out of that cultural group and makes money of it,
more money of it,
and doesn't acknowledge where it came from.
Exactly. That
seems to be the core problem for me.
Yes. Yes. There's an element of, you know, and I think it's hard to have, and I, you know, I don't know how many of the nuances of this that you all understand in Germany. I've spent a lot of time in Germany and in Switzerland, but I can't say that I necessarily understand, you know, how these cultural differences translate. Still, I don't understand. But I will say in the United States, Black, and I've had to do a video on this specifically, like when it comes to culture, it's very difficult to have those conversations when it comes to Black people in the US, because it, our culture is not always acknowledged as such. We are simply seen as a subset of American culture. Like, okay, you're here, you're different. And yeah, you've had some problems in the past, but you know, now we're all just sort of one big happy family, supposedly. And I think because of the way that, because of the history of how Blackness developed in America, this is why you have music traditions that developed here that maybe weren't even able to develop with white America, because we were cut off from African culture. We were cut off from our cultures of origin, but we were also cut off from mainstream American culture. We were also told you cannot have anything to do with us. And so when you exist in, you know, you're siloed off into, you're partitioned away from the rest of the culture, then you have to develop something that is uniquely your own. And I think a lot of people have a difficult time understanding that Blackness in the United States is not just a color. It's not just a skin color, but it is its own distinct culture. And it developed that way because of the segregation that Black people have always endured up until the last, I would say, 50 years in the United States. But that's the reason that, that, you know, we were able to develop such a strong culture within a culture is because we were not allowed to be a part of the culture at large. So I think a lot of people, when they say, they hear you say, oh, Black this or Black that, oh, well, you're segregating and you're, you know, that's, you know, you're not encouraging unity. And it's like, well, you wouldn't say that if we were speaking about Mexican culture or Spanish culture or German culture. You wouldn't say that because you acknowledge that those cultural groups or ethnic groups or whatever are their own distinct thing. Hmm. So I think there has to be kind of a deeper acknowledgement and understanding of what Black America really is. I mean, Kenyans don't claim us. Ghanans don't claim us. We really have no deep identification with any sort of African cultures. And a lot of Black people do not feel any sort of identification with mainstream American culture at all. So I think when you have these conversations, it's really important to acknowledge that Black American culture is a distinct ethnicity and a culture all its own.
But I think we do have some sort of situation here in Germany, which is somewhat comparable, because we have a very big Turkish community in Germany.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And so there's a lot of discussion going on the way that is demanded of those Turkish people that we invited after the Second World War, because we didn't have any men left to build up the country, to work in the industry. So we had something we...
Guest workers, they were called.
They were invited to Germany to help Germany getting their standing back. And now there's the third or fourth generation of those people.
Excuse me, Alexander. The interesting thing I found about the guest working thing was that they were expected to leave again after they did their job.
Yeah, when they go into pension, when they're old enough.
They
should have left. That was the concept. Just help us.
Yeah, the German concept.
Yeah, the German concept. Right. Help with the workforce, and then if you can't participate in the workforce, just go home.
If you would please leave, because otherwise we would have to pay pensions. But
guests should not overstay their welcome.
Yeah, please don't overstay your welcome.
Of course they didn't, and now we have the third or fourth generation of the descendants of those guest workers, as they were called at the time. And still, there's always a discussion, they should integrate more into German culture. And on the other hand, they do have an influence. There are, I think, around 5 million people of Turkish descent in Germany. It's a big number of people.
But they are, in some way, their own cultural group.
Yeah, somewhat segregated as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and the problem is they often see themselves as German, but they are read as Turkish. And
yes.
That creates a problem.
Yeah, and on the other hand, you actually have problems like Turkish families not really being too fond of their daughter marrying a potato German.
So it's somewhat comparable. I think the problems and the, shall I say, racism is on another level, as I perceive it in the United States of America. Still, it's getting better somewhat, but it's still there, and it's sometimes it's shocking to read news.
I think we have a huge problem here in Germany, and I think conservatism is on the rise.
Yes,
and
we're getting there.
You,
that's the problem.
Yeah, and my question to you, Dara, would be, what's your take on the current situation?
Especially concerning
and the Trump era conservatism and Trumpism and all those awful things.
Would you think it's getting worse again in America?
I tend to be very wary of saying, I mean, you know, there's always upturns and downturns, you know, society does not advance, along, a steep incline. There's always going to be kind of twists and, you know, stops and fits and all of that. But I am always wary about saying, things haven't changed. Things aren't getting any better. Mm-hmm. Because I have done so much study about the history of race in this country and racism in this country. And when you really start to do the deep dive, I think there are a lot of white folks that are not educated about race, but there are a lot of black folks that are not either. Mm-hmm. And I think when we make statements like that, general statements, like things are just getting worse and they're not getting any better. It's like, do you know what your parents went through? My father was the first, he and his brother were the first to desegregate their high school.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're talking about like actual rules and laws that said you cannot be a part of the mainstream culture. We don't want your kind here. That really just started to fade away. And my father was born in 1950. He was not born into, he should not have existed still in the era of segregation in the United States. But that a lot of that stuff did not start to burn away until the late 60s and early 70s. And a lot of high schools and churches and workplaces are still not really integrated in the U.S. But I will forever be the optimist and say that we are always, even if it doesn't feel like we're moving forward, we are always moving forward because there are always new people, new minds that are being awakened. But there clearly is a push from a political, from a very loud and vocal minority in this country, an alt-right minority in this country that is waging a huge backlash against the progress that is being made. And those types of people have always existed, but we're just dealing with the current iteration of that. And, you know, with groups like Moms for Liberty and the Heritage Foundation has been around for a long time, but these conservative groups that are really able to be very loud and very impactful on the culture. And so for that reason, I think for a lot of us who have grown up in a more progressive time, it's very scary to watch what a very vocal minority is able to do if we are not vigilant.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of nice to hear you say that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's still depressing enough.
Yeah, it's very depressing. It's very scary. And I think, you know, obviously a lot of them were emboldened, but I don't even like to say the man's name who came in a few years ago, and was thankfully jettisoned. But a lot of them were emboldened when he came along. And,
yes.
and we've got some really crazy pants folks that have been elected to public office.
And he had an impact of Europe as well, because there was the change of discourse, a change of what is possible to say, what is allowed to say loud. And we felt it here as well.
Yeah,
and that's it very harsh here in Germany as well,
that
and
is just
Europe
so crazy
as well.
To me.
It's a crazy cultural thing, Alexa, isn't it? That there just needs to be one person who is loud enough saying things you shouldn't say if you're a decent person, and suddenly
and to repeat them constantly until everyone thinks. There must be something
It seems to be okay. Yeah. I think Martin Moder said it about, I don't know, 1.5 years ago about I don't want to say his name either, actually, about the...
The orange guy.
The orange guy with the ferret on the head. It was interesting because he said, suddenly there is a guy who shows you that it's okay to be an asshole.
Nothing happens.
And nothing happens if you're an asshole. Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Now I can be an asshole too, because I enjoy being an asshole because it's so simple.
Yes.
And it's a crazy thing about human culture, actually, that there seems to be, in many people, there doesn't seem to be some kind of a dam or something against that.
The decency is missing sometimes. Just to be decent and to be polite. And one of the we do have a right wing party here in Germany,
absolutely,
the Alternative for Germany, they call themselves. I would call them fascists, and they are fascists. And they coined the term, this I will be allowed to say, at least. So and that's a direct part of the playbook that we took over from those kind of conservatives in America.
Wow.
So now you're allowed to say it.
It's so interesting. I reference Henry Ford and you all's awful, horrible, bad guy that existed in the 30s and 40s. And it's how influenced that the dude with the mustache was by Henry Ford and by American segregation and Jim Crow laws. How he took a lot of his methodologies and thought processes from us. I mean, we in America look at, I'll just say his name, Hitler. We look at him as like the worst possible representation of the worst kind of racist evil. But he was taking a lot of cues and methodologies from watching us. And I think that's something that a lot of people in the United States do not realize. They don't know, they don't understand, but it's like, man, the world is watching us. And when we do evil, it is felt by everyone. When we do good, it is felt by everyone as well. So most Americans have absolutely no idea of how influential our culture is on the rest of the world.
Just to educate our German viewers, Hitler was so impressed by Ford that the Volkswagen Beetle, he said, it's every German has to have a car, and the Volkswagen Beetle was an invention by Hitler really pushed for that car, and he took the conveyor belt from Ford. He said to make it cheap and viable for all Germans, we have to take this concept. So there is a direct connection. And now saying Hitler's the worst person there ever was, and he probably is, we should acknowledge that, but it helps American culture to cleanse themselves, to say, well, we were bad, but he was even worse. He's even worse. And, well, maybe we had some influence, but, man, we're not that bad. But
at least we are not Hitler. Well, that's great if you can say that. Well, at least I'm not Hitler. That's not much.
Right. Right. And Hitler was taking his cues from Jim Crow segregation in the United States. Let's meditate on that.
Would you please explain this expression? I heard it quite a lot of times, Jim Crow and Jim Crow laws, but actually I'm I know what it represents, but I don't really know what it is.
Are you speaking specifically of
specifically
the character?
Of that expression, Jim Crow, what the name represents? When you say that, what?
Well, then the character was taken from a folk song.
Okay.
It's just a representative of a lazy, ignorant Black person. It is a stereotype and a minstrel character. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of you probably know what the minstrel tradition is in the United States. It's blackface, and it's basically white people and sometimes Black people dressing up and imitating like slaves and caricatures from the you know, slavery times.
So Jim Crow stands for a caricature of sorts.
Yes, Jim Crow is a caricature from minstrelsy that represents a kind of a singing and dancing ignorant Black slave. And so for whatever reason, the set of laws that governed mostly the South, but many places in the North after slavery ended, and after the Compromise of 1877, so all of the Northern soldiers left and basically left Black people to the just to the mercy of the very, very racist white people that remained in the South after slavery ended. So after that happened, they basically instituted a set of laws that said, we are segregating ourselves from Black people. Black people cannot come into these spaces. They cannot mingle with us in these ways. They are not allowed to have these specific jobs, and basically, creating a lot of restrictions around their movement and behavior, and imprisoning a lot of Black men without just cause, and basically turning them into slaves all over again. So it was a very, very evil and very. This is why a lot of, you know, when we talk about the effects and the impacts of slavery, it can be very frustrating because not many people want to talk about the impacts of Jim Crow, which extended for another 70 years after slavery. We were still dealing with the impacts of Jim Crow laws, which was legal segregation. And that did not officially end until Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, which integrated, I'm putting this in quotation marks, integrated, at least legally integrated American schools. And even that process was resisted for a long time. So just to talk about slavery and the impacts of that is not enough. We have to talk about what happened after slavery as well, which was just, hey, Black people, stay away from us. We don't want to have anything to do with you, you know, and which can explain a lot about why Black people have had the kind of social and financial struggles in the country that they have had, and why it's taken so long for us to progress kind of as a people, because of segregation. It wasn't enough to say slavery ended, but to say you're not allowed to integrate with the culture, you have no education. It was illegal to educate Black people. And so we're going to throw you out into society and then make sure that you stay away from us for 70 years. I mean, it's amazing that any Black person, in my estimation, it's amazing that Black people have accomplished what they have. And a lot of the progress I think that Black America has been able to make is due to our reliance on our gifting for music and for expression, artistic expression of all kinds. It has been a way out for a lot of Black folks, which is why this conversation around cultural appropriation can be such a sensitive topic for
us. So I understand, if I understand you correctly, the fact that music was one of the ways to kind of deal with it, it makes it even harder that then exactly this thing that kind of is a unique thing was taken.
Yes.
And exploit it.
Commercially and...
Okay.
Yeah. And it's like, it's the only thing for a long time. And even now, you know, to a large degree, it's like, this is our artistic expression is the only way that a lot of Black folks can get out of, you know, economically disadvantaged situations. So it's like, if you're going to get out, it's probably going to be that. Maybe these days it's going to be sports.
Or sports, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be that. And so to have that taken, it makes it just doubly injurious.
And I saw that white men seem to be able to jump too sometimes.
Sometimes they can. or at the very least, they own the purse strings of people who are.
Damn,
who are
I saw that white person jump. Alexander, you look like you have something to.
There are some questions in the chat. We can address them now or maybe later.
Yeah.
So one of the questions that came up quite frequently is, how do we deal with it as white folks listening to music? And now we've been educated. It's really appropriated music. What should we do with ourselves? So you can't give us absolvement. You can say, I make it good. Now you can listen to it. But it's a concern a lot of people have wrote in the chat. What I'm supposed to do now?
If I may add to that, it's the same feeling that I have when I read something from an author where I found out he's just the absolute asshole.
Yeah.
Like, what's the anti-Semitic horror icon?
H.P. Lovecraft.
H.P. Lovecraft. Yeah. You know, when you hear about him being such a super racist asshole, and then say, okay, I read that, I kind of enjoyed that, I'm not allowed to enjoy that anymore. You know, I was quite a fan of the music, I must say, of Eric Clapton until I found out about his racist slurs in the 70s, albeit under a strong alcohol influence. But still, I mean, there has to be some assholian core if you start ranting on stage want all the people with a different skin color out of England. I mean, it's just horrible. And it's the same thing. I don't know what to feel anymore. And now you have to give us, what do you say? Absolutation? Is that the word?
I don't
know. Absolution.
Absolution.
Yeah. Dress up in a white gown, extend your hands and I give you absolution. You're allowed to hear the music you like. If you could do that, that would be nice, actually.
I can only provide that.
Damn!
Daryl.
Go ahead.
Okay, I can only speak for myself, but I do feel ashamed to have read certain books and to have liked certain authors and liked certain music. And for us Europeans, there is also the heritage of colonialism.
Oh, yeah.
And it's only recently that we have begun to be aware of our mistakes and to even try to reconcile in a way. And I do feel ashamed. I can admit it publicly. That was I worked on that, and I try to be aware of the mistakes, and I try to do better.
Yeah,
maybe in the future. That's a certain way to deal with it. Maybe.
And there's a lot of people out there who would say, you don't have to be ashamed. You can like what you have liked. You don't have to. And I think in some way, for me at least, it's liberating to be ashamed.
Yeah.
It's a crazy feeling. I can't really explain that. I cannot explain a lot in this stream, but that's another thing that I can't explain. That it's a kind of liberation to be able to say, yes, I actually feel ashamed that things occurred the way they occurred and that I liked stuff that I didn't, because I didn't know. Mm. And now that I know and that I can say it out loud, it kind of gives me, it makes me feel better to acknowledge it.
Just to give Dara some context, what it means when you say that.
Yeah.
Tommy was a real big fan of, and he's a writer, a prolific writer of children's literature. He didn't talk about that in our pre-show. He's very successful. And a children's book he read as a child, and he really wanted to do
an audio play
for children, and it's a story where a very Scottish guy goes to North America, and deals with Native Americans. And at the time, it was usual
in the 70s when it was written.
There were Indians, and they used the term, and we know now that we shouldn't use it or be more sensible about the topic. And in general, white folks going to America to visit the Native Americans.
Yeah, and every cliche you could possibly think of was in that books, and I didn't know when I was a child. I didn't know that these were horrible cliches. Yeah. I know that the author, he never meant no harm. I met him when he was alive, and he's the sweetest person you can ever think of. But then I thought, I'd really, really, really would like to transform these books that I loved so much into audio plays, with sounds and music and different actors and stuff. But the problem was, I would have to rewrite that quite a lot to even to not feel bad about it, And so what I tried to do was I tried to get in touch with some kind of Native American community culture, and it was just not possible in Germany because I thought of casting people who would, be able to talk Apache because they are. I couldn't find any. So what I did was I tried to get in touch, or my production assistant, Mel, she tried to get in touch in America with the communities in America. And there was some interesting thing happening because we actually got an answer that was kind of sweet and kind of disappointing because they said, "We really appreciate what you're trying to do. We really do. But we can't help you because if we would help you, having a German narrator or a German actor trying to express, original Apache or whatever, this would be cultural appropriation. We cannot help you, but we really appreciate that you're trying to. So please don't stop trying, and we wish you the best of luck, but we won't help you with that." This was really strange, and it was totally sweet, and it was totally understandable and acceptable, and they really encouraged us to try, but they didn't want to have any involvement in it. So what we ended up with was I changed the main character in so far as that he didn't use the word Indian, because in Germany it's even more not okay than in America. And he used the word Native American and whatever and all that stuff, and he kind of had the stance in the story that he didn't have in the original, where he said acknowledged all the stuff that happened to the Native Americans, and he verbalized it in the audio play for children, which I thought was at least some kind of education. And what we tried to do was get every information about Apache and other languages that we could, and try to learn it ourselves as good as we could, to at least have the feeling that we did everything we could to not make it stupid and to not steal something, and to kind of tell many, many, many people about the wrong that has been done. And on the other hand, to acknowledge this wonderful culture. And I am reluctantly pleased to say that I got a lot of reactions from people, from kids, from grown-ups, from many, many people who said, "We learned a lot, and we can kind of acknowledge now that stuff that has been told about the Native Americans, frankly, was really, really stupid."
Yeah.
And still, I'm not happy. And if we would do an animation show, we were thinking about animating it. I still would try again to have Native Americans do the voice acting, and have Native Americans schooling me about what to say and how to say it and what not to do. Because I really, really want to make things right, but it's so hard. And it's a gray area, you know? It's not like you said before. You can't say, "Yeah, do this, then it will be okay." You can't.
Right.
You can only try to make it as good as possible, and still it's not going to be,
super okay. And yeah, you've done that right. Here is your medal, your right. wokeness medal. You can wear it now, Tommy. You did great. There is nothing better to do. Will not happen.
Right.
But at least we tried.
Yeah. But I think the main thing to take from that experience, and you talked a lot about it, is to try to educate yourself and to try to understand what you're doing, to reflect.
Get better.
And to reflect on what you're doing. As an artist, you mm-hmm. have you have to be very aware. And if we, on a whole, would do that, just going through your CD rack and say, okay, let's see. What do I listening to? Just coming back to the absolvent, so I have to do it now. I will put on the right one. But it's the first step of understanding why you should think about it. Why you
at least think about
reflect
it.
About it. You could educate yourself. You could watch videos from Dara and sit there in astonishment and say, that sound is not from that guy, but from those guys.
Yeah.
So it could be interesting to hear what those guys have done also. So I have to listen. I can listen more to the original,
which is
artists.
interesting because you are not the biggest blues fan I know.
No,
actually not at all.
Not not right,
but
just to go on the journey and to understand what happened there, because further down the line I still listen to rock and heavy metal and all that stuff. It originated somewhere.
Yeah.
So if I try to educate myself to see where it's coming from, it helps.
It helps.
At least.
And
someone to appreciate. The original
to appreciate,
art?
Yeah.
Probably,
hey,
maybe.
We finally got to the point
maybe.
Of appreciation.
Doesn't make it good.
Well, but at least, I don't know, there are, at least if there is some appreciation involved, that's kind of the first step, maybe.
I think when
help
you talk about
help us.
I think when you talk about, because what we're essentially the delineation that we're making between just cultural exchange and cultural appropriation,
right,
is that there is a power differential. There are power dynamics that are involved, and there are historical realities that are involved. And so when those things come into play, it naturally it gets more complicated than just an exchange of cultures. So I think I am one of those. It is my personal feeling that it is not really possible for there not to be an exploitative element when a dominant culture uses elements that come from, you know, the non-dominant culture or an exploited or marginalized culture. It is not possible for there not to be some element of exploitation. It's going to exist either way. So the only thing that you can really do to guard yourself against overly participating in that exploitation is to educate yourself, is to give acknowledgement, and to make sure to shine a light on those people whose culture that you're pulling from, and to make sure if there are ways for them to be compensated. I think one example of an artist I think that did a really good job of that was Paul Simon, you know, during his Graceland period, where he used a lot of musicians from the South African community. And when he wanted to do that South African music, he didn't go and get a bunch of white guys and say, hey, you know, we could play like this. And have you heard these recordings? And, you know, let's imitate that. He could have done it in that way, but he didn't. He went and got, you know, this group, Black Africa, Mumbaza, I think I'm saying that in the right way. And he pulled them in and he had them play on his album. And then he went and got, you know, these singers and dancers from South Africa and he put them there. I remember seeing, cause I was a kid when that album came out, and he would do these appearances on David Letterman or other shows and he would put them out front. It wasn't just like, hey, there's some guys that happen to be back here with me and nobody really knows who they are. It's like, no, it was almost as though they were performing. And Paul Simon was like almost like accompanying them, you know, in their performance. And I just went and saw Black Africa, Mumbaza. I hope I'm saying that the right way. But I just saw them a few months ago at the City Winery here in Philadelphia. They still have a career. because of what Paul Simon did for them. And he pushed them. He promoted them. He got in a lot of trouble for performing in South Africa during apartheid, but he did it to draw attention to the issues that were happening in that country at the time. I mean, it was a total investment that he made into just lifting them up, shining a light on the issues that were important to them, and then helping them to develop a career of their own. And that's, I think, a really unusual example of someone who did borrow and grab and pull from another culture, but he did it in a way that actually provided some nourishment and some sustenance to them. Mm-hmm. And it just does not happen very often.
That's really good to hear for us. Thank you.
At least the first part should happen.
Well,
more often.
It was one.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It was one. But I would really like to take this opportunity for the other two things that I found. What makes it three things I found together with Paul Simon, which is not that much, but at least it shows, if it's not retribution for us, really it's not, but it shows that it's possible.
I found Ladysmith, I'm so sorry, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, forgive me.
Okay. In 1960, I'm reading this from Far Out magazine from the UK. In 1964, the Beatles produced an act of defiance, which ultimately made a huge step toward fighting racial segregation. The band, with thousands of people waiting, refused to play at a show that had split the audience by race without their consent. Showing the support for the U.S. civil rights movement, the iconic Liverpool four-piece refused to perform to a segregated concert at the Gator Bowl in Jacksonville, Florida. As the pressure of the Beatles' act of defiance threatened to boil over, officials at the concerts eventually allowed the segregated audience to merge together. Upon entering the stage, John Lennon said, through the microphone, "We never play to segregated audience, and we aren't going to start now. I'd sooner lose our appearance money," he added. The details of the incident were later captured in the documentary The Beatles 8 Days a Week. It's a film that I strongly recommend watching, which is really good, and especially that part is just gut-wrenchingly wonderful. The first controversial political stance didn't have to do with Vietnam, Howard said, the director. It had to do with segregation in the South. They found out that one of the concerts in Jacksonville was meant to be segregated, and they refused to play that way. They even had in their contract that they would not play to segregated audience. So this is one example, and it seemed to have had a really big impact, actually, which is wonderful. And the other thing that I found, I'm trying to shorten that because it's really long. May 26, 1965, the Rolling Stones performed on the ABC variety show Shindig, where they introduced one of their big influences, bluesman Howlin' Wolf, Chester Arthur Bennett, who sings How Many More Years. It was the first time, and this is really, I think, Dara, you have to talk about that after, but it's the first time that many Americans first glimpsed the face of true blues.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird.
Oh, yeah.
It's surely one of the most incongruous, I never heard that word, moments in American pop music. A music journalist named Peter Guralnik said he reversed Howlin' Wolf, went even further. He called it one of the greatest cultural moments of the 20th century. What was so great about seeing Howlin' Wolf on Shindig was that it was, in a sense, reality imposing itself on this totally artificial setting. I was a big fan of the Stones. It was altogether appropriate that they would be sitting at Wolf's feet. And that's what it represented. His music was not the foundation or the cornerstone. It was the most vital thing you could ever imagine. And I'm getting to the end here. Blues guitarist Buddy Guy said of this moment, "It was some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. There was a boundary line which no one thought could be crossed, and the Rolling Stones broke it by getting Howlin' Wolf on that show. It was something we would never even have thought of. The hairs were standing on my head." I'm getting shivers from that. That this could mean so much. That you can actually do that, and that another great blues artist, Buddy Guy, would have his hair standing on his head because another blues artist got put on the show. Wow. I mean,
yeah. I mean, if you think about it, you know, I mean, they had been doing what they were doing, you know. I think I mentioned in the video, the rock and roll, who invented rock and roll, that these, that kind of boogie woogie groove, that rhythm and that feel had begun as, you know, as far back as the 1870s, when these guys were riding on trains and they were kind of imitating the syncopation of the, the train, you know, moving. And so these styles had been developing. You think about that being the 1870s. This is like almost 100 years after some of that music, you know, not to mention just straight up, you know, Delta blues, you know, how long this music had existed. And it was really just being acknowledged by a mainstream audience in the mid 60s. And which kind of, you know, speaks to a lot of why this conversation has always been so important to Black America, because it's something we've always been aware has been a problem in terms of representation. But I don't think really a lot of white Americans and white people across the globe really think about just the ways in which our culture has been really just, I don't really like to use the word stolen, but a lot of people use the word stolen.
Used.
Co-opted in that way. It's really sad to think about. And I think about, as I was saying before, Elvis Presley, and how I think accurately, Tommy, you were saying, there was never really a moment, or there were never really moments where Elvis did that, you know, that acknowledgement of like, hey, this is, you know, there was that one article in Jet Magazine where he acknowledged and tipped his hat to Fats Domino.
It's not that much, actually.
Yeah, that's not a lot. He didn't, as I said, he did not talk to the press, but he didn't have moments in concerts where he would bring out Black musicians, and that was just not something that he would do. So I feel like, in a way, the Beatles and the, you know, more so the Stones, when they would put people like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf at the forefront, they were doing this very purposefully and very intentionally, because they saw the cautionary tale with Elvis Presley in the way that this was handled just badly. Frankly, it was just handled badly with so many white artists of the early rock era, like Jerry Lee Lewis and Bill Haley and many others, who never really acknowledged who their influences were. They never really acknowledged these guys who could never get airplay on mainstream radio stations. And so, you know, this was a corrective action that the Stones and the Beatles were taking.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, I heard the Beatles say that they were astonished that when they went to America, that people thought that didn't know. They kind of said that, we played songs by the old rock and roll artists, the Black rock and roll artists. People, the white audience thought it's songs. These songs are from the Beatles. I mean, originated from the Beatles.
And they did cover it.
Yeah, right. And they covered it. And they said, "How can it be that so many people never heard of Little Richard? He's one of our big idols. We love him. We want part of the reason why they went to America was so they could meet Little Richard, and they did." Mm-hmm. And the crazy thing is that the people in America, the major audience, the major white audience, didn't seem to know about him. Mm-hmm. It's just crazy. And that's
there's a certain taken for grantedness, I think, because, as I was saying before, that acknowledgement, that lack of acknowledgement that Black American culture is its own distinct thing. Mm-hmm. There tends to be a dismissal of Black American culture as just a subset of American culture. Well, you just happen to be here, and you've had problems and you've had issues, but quit whining, quit complaining about it, you know, and just live your life, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And I think having the bird's eye view living in Europe, I think that delineation between what Black, you know, mainstream American culture and what Black American culture are, can be a lot easier to see. It's a lot easier to draw those two things out and say, well, we can clearly see, you know, where the influence of this thing is coming from, versus just having a bunch of white kids there that are grabbing it and spoon feeding it to the rest of the culture, which is what happens here.
Kuratorium in the chat wrote, I can't verify it, but I take it for granted that the German reggae artist Gentleman, he's quite successful in Germany, seemed to have done it right. He lived in Jamaica for 8 years, educated himself about the music he does, and he always features Jamaican artists on stage when he goes on tour.
Yeah, so that's the thing.
That's how you should do it. If you take this influence, show the people that
and
live and have this music as their culture.
And I really want to emphasize this: have people who did something that you take, have them earn money.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds like you know, oh, you're talking about money. This is a greater issue. No, sometimes it isn't.
Yeah.
You know, give the people the money that they. That they
deserve.
I mean, it's just crazy, and I can understand if the black community in or the blues community in itself says, "Well, we're taking this and that from him and from that and then," and it's okay for us, but that doesn't give any white guy the right to do the same, because that's what Led Zeppelin seemed to use as some kind of an excuse to say, "Well, the black guys, they're doing it." So why can't we do it? And this is not...
You need to be aware of the fact that we white people are used to taking without giving back. And that's something that has to change.
Yes. Right.
As simple as that.
Right, yeah.
And through the centuries, it's like this. It's always been like this. The white people came, took everything, made it their own, and it was okay. Nobody was there to say, this is wrong what you're
Well, doing. If they try to, they got...
killed.
Yeah.
So and that's the reason why we have to educate ourselves and the general community that this is not the right way to do things.
You know, here in Germany, I don't know. Are you aware of this freakish thing called virtue signaling? You probably are.
Virtue signaling. Yeah.
Virtue signaling. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, we get accused of that.
All the time.
All the time. Because people are saying, oh, we are doing that so that we can kind of show people how great we are and how woke we are. Well, we are, but... No, I mean, but I don't see any other... I mean, at the minute that you say something like that, you're kind of virtue signaling because you do. I don't know how else would you I mean, if you say it, then you say it, then it's out there and people can accuse you of saying it just because you want to make yourself feel better. And
there's always the danger of conveying this picture, but I think that would mean it doesn't come from the heart, but it does. So.
Yeah, it's not that the what people say is you don't believe in that. You say you are aware. You say you
and you're just doing that because you want to put yourself on a
pedestal, or you want to earn money with it. But I don't believe that you really believe that. Inclusion is another topic of disabled people, and in Germany as well as in the United States of America, the whole discussion about transgender and how to include those people in society, and how to you should maybe change a little bit the language just to show that those people are there, that you include them in your everyday life. And in Germany, we do have a lot of more complicated way of diverting people through language, so it's even harder for us to include people. And they say, well, yeah, you write it on Twitter, you say it in your podcast, but I don't believe that you really believe it.
You're just doing that because you want to
virtue signaling.
Yeah.
And that says a lot about the people that write that, because they can't imagine that someone is trying to do those things. It says a lot about the people that write that stuff, more so than about us trying to do the right things.
That's why I think you shouldn't really give a whole lot of attention to trying to learn how to engage with that argument, because it really is just a sort of rote across the board statement that's made in response to someone supporting values that person does not support. It's the same with the word woke. I actually have a video that's coming out on the origins of that word, which of course come from the Black community.
Yeah.
Oh, that we stole that also.
Yeah.
Right.
They stole it. And they have appropriated.
Yeah. If we do something, we do it proper.
We take everything.
Yes. That word has been appropriated as well. So it's like, these are just words that are used to basically dismiss a particular point of view. And I don't think it's an argument that's made in earnest. It's not a sincere argument. It's just a dismissive thing to say. And I don't think you should spend any energy trying to engage with it. That's my feeling about it.
Well, after Elon bought Twitter, it changed a lot. And you get a lot of backlash like that. So it's not a hospitable place. And for us as being people that live our lives through the internet, you just somewhat have to engage. We know how to block and mute people.
Yeah,
no problem.
But still,
there,
but let it be said that the backlash that we get is just ridiculously small compared to people who really have problems.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So we won't complain about that. We shouldn't. Mm-hmm. We really shouldn't. It gets on my nerves, but it's nothing compared to what other people have to deal with on a daily basis. Yeah. And you know, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but to me, if a big company does some kind of virtue signaling because they think that it's good for their business, some little voice in me says, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least they think it's better that way.
Right.
I know that this is... It has a hypocritical feel to it if you accuse them of they're just doing that because this and that. But
you know, when Mercedes-Benz is changing for 1 month their logo into the rainbow color because of the awareness month, and they do it all around the world, and you see that the Saudi Arabian account of Mercedes-Benz doesn't change, that's a problem. Yeah. Then you have to stand up and say, we also convey those things even where we think it will harm our business. This is a problem. If they would change it everywhere, and you can look.
I understand what you say. If it harms their business, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah, and that's not. I think it's a little bit weak to deal with. Understandable from a financial and capitalistic view.
From an Assholian point of view, it's totally understandable.
Well, yeah, you said it.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. So, how can we wrap that up?
What are your hopes for the future? What do you think should happen in the future about the discussion of this topic, the change that should happen?
I would just hope that there would be more. It really encourages me to talk to you all. As being people who live in Europe and people who aren't even necessarily tied to the history of a lot of what we're discussing, the fact that you all have an interest in learning and understanding this is just such, you know, as I said, I've spent a lot of time in Germany and Switzerland. I didn't necessarily know a lot of people who would sit down and have conversations like this. And so it's just very cool for me to interact with and to observe. So my hope is just that more people would be educated about things like this, and that it would not be something that we would suddenly have to come into the knowledge of when we're way later in our, even me, you know, we're late into our adulthood, and it's like, oh, well, my goodness, you know, a lot of what I've been taught is wrong. I would hope that it would just become a part of the cultural conversation from when we're very small. But I know that there are a lot of forces, at least here in the United States, that are very resistant to it and are waging kind of anti-information campaigns against it and really want to put out counter messaging to say that it's, I ran into a few videos, like I said, that were people like Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson were basically saying, this is not a real thing. This does cultural appropriation does not exist, which I think is just, and of course I didn't take time to watch them and just, you know, take in the absolute foolery, but to think that anyone would have the audacity to make a statement like that is just, it's a sad thing to me. Yep. So I would hope that more people would just be educated, and what you all are doing is so important, because you're educating other people, because you're curious and you're educating yourselves, then there will be more people that will be educated and understand and just get the nuances of the conversation. And that's all it takes. Like Tommy was saying, there's something that is actually freeing in, you know, having an appropriate sense of shame. Like, that's not a bad thing. We have such a backlash here in this country with people like Ron DeSantis saying, well, you shouldn't be telling little white kids, you know, about the history of race in this country, because it's going to make them embarrassed. It's going to make them feel bad about being white. And it's like, well, to some degree, maybe there should be some tinge of like, wow, you know, I'm really kind of embarrassed to be connected with, you know, a history like this. But moving on from that, this is what I can do differently. This is how I can conduct myself in a way that makes me an agent of change in the world. It doesn't have to stop with shame. Shame does not have to be the end of the story, but it's important not to avoid that feeling of shame, because it's the catalyst that can help you to actually take a step forward and say, you know, I can do something about this. I can help other people to learn and help other people to do better in the future. So just not running from the discomfort is so important. So I'm really thankful for you guys. I'm thankful for people like you that want to have these conversations, because they are so necessary. And I'm so glad to hear that these conversations are being had across the pond and across cultures, because, you know, you all have your own history to grapple with.
Yeah, we got a lot to do. If we want something to be ashamed of, that's
there's not
right.
a problem.
It's not
hard to find something.
And that's, you know, that I think also is indicative of the ways in which, from what I know about German culture, I know that there have been measures that have been taken to educate young German kids about, you know, your history. And so you're doing something, you know, some basic thing right that we are not always willing to do in this country. That basic education has to happen. So that's my hope for the future, is that that we would stop being afraid of knowledge and of education, and would stop being afraid of the feeling of shame, and to understand that it can be empowering. Yeah. It can be empowering because now you're equipped, and you don't just cower in a corner, and you know, it's not a disempowering thing. It's something that can actually help you to be more effective in your lives going forward.
Yes. Thank you so much.
There's a lot of applause in the chat. I just see clapping hands in the chat. So,
and, you know,
exploding.
You know, I mean, how many people did we reach today? Can you give us an estimate?
I think there are some around 4,000 people visible that have a Twitch account at the moment right now.
4,000 people heard what you had to say.
Wow.
And I think to a vast extent, applauded.
And yes.
Those three or four people who didn't.
Were kicked off the chat.
Were kicked off
very,
the chat.
Very fast. Thanks a lot to
I know about those people.
Yeah. Thank a lot to our mods that make our chat a safe place for people to
be.
That's
really great.
It's great that you did. Great job, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to the moderators.
It's really a goosebump moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Dara. I'm so, so, so happy that you said yes to this invitation. This was an absolute bliss.
Danke für die Einladung.
Oh, really. Now she talks German.
Now you're coming back. We had to have... don't tell me that you're that good in German. Please don't, after what we did today.
No, I'm not that good. It's been so long since I lived over there. I've lost a lot of it, but I can probably make very, very small talk that is very remedial.
So it's like, guten Abend, wie geht es Ihnen? Stuff like that.
Oh, it's a little better than that, but it's
okay.
Okay, so but
it's not as good as it should be.
Okay, so it's not good enough to talk about cultural appropriation for 1.5 hours.
No.
Good, because if you would have said that now, I would have felt kind of betrayed.
das kann ich nicht machen. Is that right? Did I say that properly?
Yes,
actually, it sounds perfect.
Yeah. You nailed it.
Yeah.
That sounds a little too good for my feelings, actually.
Hey.
Actually, all the
guttural... Yeah. Secret.
Yeah, but this guttural thing, machen, that's really machen. Good because normally, Americans, they tend to do machen instead of machen.
Right.
So you really have that.
I think singers, I think, probably have a little bit better ear for pronunciation. And I maybe fool you into thinking I speak it better than I do because I pronounce it better than I actually speak it. So that makes sense.
Okay, so thanks again. Thank you very much. I encourage everyone in the chat to check out Dara's videos. They are really enlightening, and they are, as I said, I think they're kind of fair. You know what I'm trying to get across? They're not blaming. Really, but I mean, they blame in the right moments because there is something to blame, but they're fair, and you always feel that people are treated fair, artists are treated fairly. And I really, really, really encourage you to watch that. I also encourage you to watch, if you're interested in stuff like that, the latest podcast I thought that you uploaded was about the Dilbert guy.
Oh, yeah.
There's been one since then, but
This was really interesting. It was really interesting to dig deeper if you're interested in stuff like that. This cartoon guy who seems to live in his own world, actually, it seems like that, like the thing you said, like cowering in a corner, being afraid of black people.
Mm-hmm.
Really weird shit.
Is very weird. Endlessly weird. That guy is as baffling as they come. I almost hated to devote a podcast to him, but I think he's actually not as unusual as you might think. I think there are a lot of folks like him, unfortunately. Hmm. Oh yeah. Ugh. Yeah.
Okay. So if we happen to come across another topic that might involve stuff where we might have the idea to maybe think about optionally calling you again, would you, in an ideal world, be happy to think about the possibility to do that again?
Please. Yeah, ich würde das gern haben. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Ich habe das gern.
Great. Wir haben das auch sehr gerne. Wir würden uns sehr freuen.
Yes.
Okay.
Ich muss jetzt auch Deutsch sprechen, ne?
Ja, ja.
It's really hard to speak in German right now.
Ja.
Wir machen das einfach.
Ja, genau.
I lost all language at the moment. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Dara. Thanks to everyone.
Danke sehr.
And there's a lot of positive comments and people really took something from the show. A lot of people wrote, I learned something today. So,
well.
I'm so glad. I'm really glad. And thank you all for being receptive. Thank your audience for being receptive. Thank you so much.
Since my eyes are wetting and I don't want anyone to see this, I'm switching off. I'm German, at least, you know.
I'm not British.
Off. I'm not British. At least I'm not British, because then it would be a total other thing. We are switching to our extra now. And Dara, I'm going to send you a link where you can rewatch the video on demand, and you can scroll through the comments.
Mm-hmm. Comments, okay.
If that's your idea of a good time,
which are really interesting.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Not that bad.
Yeah.
It's really not that bad.
So, Dara, please don't go away. I'll switch to the outro. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Bye.